I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. Hi, this is Howard Jacobson, and I am thrilled, delighted, and honored today to be talking to Dr. Ruth Heidrich. Hello, Dr. Ruth.
Hello, Howard. So nice to be online with you, all the way from Hawaii.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Hawaii, whether we all need to move there to age gracefully.
Well, I started out for a run this morning. I got 2 miles, and it started pouring. And I decided, so I turned around and ran the second 2 miles in the rain. But the weather, the temperature, you still can't complain. It just builds more character. So, come on out. It's great.
Awesome. So for folks who don't know you and aren't familiar with your story, I have a brief introduction bio that you sent to me that kind of gives some of the highlights that we'll be delving into. So you're famous for being I guess breast cancer free for how many years now?
31.
31 years. So you were basically in 1982 at the age of 47 diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer.
Yes.
And basically I think told to put your affairs in order.
Yep.
And so 31 years later, I guess your affairs still aren't in order because you're...
Yeah. Well, I still can't consider it cured because I don't believe there is a, quote, cure for cancer. I really believe that if I went back to eating the way I was before, that those dormant cancer cells would spring to life again. So that keeps me on the straight and narrow. Mm. For many other reasons as well, not just the cancer. I found out there were so many other advantages. My gosh, my arthritis disappeared, my constipation disappeared, acne, dandruff. It's just amazing. Oh, my high blood cholesterol. I was told by Dr. John McDougall, with a cholesterol this high, you are at as great a risk of dying of a heart attack as you are the breast cancer. And here I was running marathons, fit, slim, certainly not the stereotype of a breast cancer patient. And it was such a blow, such a shock, it just shook my world to the very ground. And then to be told at risk of a heart attack too. So it was a teaching moment, as they love to say. I listened to every word and did it.
Mm. Well, and since then, since you've been vegan now for 31 years, it doesn't seem to have impaired your athletic performance any. You're a 6-time Ironman finisher. You've run 67 marathons.
Yes.
Including Boston, New York, Moscow, Honolulu. You've run the Great Wall of China.
Yeah. all since that horrible diagnosis, and I owe it all to the diet. No question.
Right, and I would love, I want to get into kind of that combination, because I've just downloaded on Kindle and been reading your book, Senior Fitness, which I guess is maybe 10 years old now?
is it really?
Something like that, six or seven or eight now. I bought it based on the reviews on Amazon that basically told me, well, why not start now?
yeah.
You know, and that's,
and senior, everybody is a senior, whether you're a senior in high school, senior in university, or a senior at 40. So I wondered if the title of that book would deter somebody from saying, I'm not a senior. But,
well, I have to say, you know, one of my careers is marketer, and I did feel like the title of that book, so now I'm about 40% of the way into it, so I have a fairly good sense of what's in it. I think the title of the book should be, you know, give this to everybody you love before it's too late. Like, senior fitness is kind of a mild title compared to really the incredible gift of your research as well as your personal experience in helping people be not just sort of, you know, healthy, not just sort of, you know, functioning, but really like, you know, squaring that curve to the point where 80 doesn't have to be much less vigorous than 40.
Hopefully, I'm not quite there yet, but I have my fingers crossed. It also gives me the motivation just to keep on pushing and not let those little thoughts that occur to most people as they age. Well, you know, you're getting older now. Well, you ought to be taking it easy. Well, here, Grandma, let me get this for you. I resist that. I say, by gosh, if I push this hard yesterday, I'm going to push harder today. Now, there are some effects. There's no question about it. I'm slower. There's, you know, can't help it. It seems like I'm going just as fast. But it's not a perfect panacea. But I think, well, we can talk again when I hit 100, and I'll let you know.
Okay, well, I'll work on being around when you hit 100. I'm 48, so I'm taking your advice to heart.
Oh, good.
I've done a lot of work and reading on sort of hero's journey and spiritual life cycles, and you know, clearly one of the goals of life is not to be at 80 the way we were at 20. But, you know, I kind of feel like each part of life has its own energy, has its own challenges, and really what you're talking about is having the physical capability to participate, to dive fully into all those challenges, whether they're physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, relational, that, you know, life is always going to be throwing us things for our for our development. And you know we see so many you know, my mom is 93 or 94.
Wow.
And, you know, she's you know, fairly unresponsive in a chair in a nursing home watching movies. You know, it's hard to see, you know, and that the medical malpractice that has been foisted upon her and all of us in that idea that, you know, your diet and your lifestyle have nothing to do. This is just a crapshoot.
Yeah, it's really sad how people are misled, and that the profit motive and misinformation is so prevalent, and it's so hard to discount. Most people I talk to think they know what they've been taught ever since they were children, and it's really hard to turn that around. I sometimes wonder how come I was so lucky. I'm not a genius. I always did well in school, and fortunately in graduate school I was exposed to graduate level statistics and research design, and I credit all that experience with being open to looking at the research studies. So when I was going back and forth right after the diagnosis, and first talking to the surgeon and then the oncologist and then talking to Dr. John McDougall, who said, change your diet, I was really confused because I'd talk to one side and they'd convince me. So I'd take those arguments and go to the other side and then walk away convinced that that was right. And back and forth for a couple of weeks, thank goodness Dr. McDougall showed me the research that was available even back then, 30 years ago. Some people knew this information was valid. And I was so lucky to have been in the right place at the right time and to be open enough despite all the resistance. My then husband, when I came home after my first talk with Dr. McDougall and told him what I'd found out, that it's the diet that caused my cancer and it's the diet that can reverse it. I'm not having chemo, I'm not having radiation, I'm not having tamoxifen, just changing my diet. My ex, now ex, because of his reaction was, I can't believe you've fallen for that quack. I gave you credit for more intelligence than that. And boy, when someone insults my intelligence, and, you know, that just, oh boy. And my friends, my relatives, there was total resistance everywhere I turned, except for this one man, John McDougall. You know, I owe him so much. And in reading what Dr. T. Colin Campbell has gone through, I see the parallels. It's so similar. And it's enlightening that more people are maybe getting this information out, and then the ideas can grow. That's my only hope, that by telling people, this is what you need to know, and here's the proof.
Well, yeah, I'm struck by how different things were in 1982 than they are today, just in terms of the internet. And it was you surrounded by naysayers and one doctor who may or may not have been crazy,
everybody thought he was.
People still do, yeah. Right?
Yeah, right. Yes.
He's outliving all his critics, but that doesn't stop them from reading.
Yeah.
But you know, to kind of go with your ability to read a research study and evaluate research design, and I'd love to get a little bit more into that in a little bit. But also, I'm imagining there was just some degree of gut feel, like this just makes sense more than the people who can't help me.
Yes, because Dr. McDougall, he said, well, tell your oncologist to show you how the chemo and radiation extends lives or helps with the cancer. And I went back to my oncologist, who, by the way, died of a heart attack at age 45. I would watch him in his office and lean back in his chair and see this big belly and just kind of shake my head. It's too bad that he's not listening, because this is another doctor who has the information. But anyway, he couldn't come up with any. He just scoffed at the idea that I would want to see any data, because he was so convinced that chemo and radiation are what you do when you have cancer. And of course, tamoxifen back in 82 was still a research drug. They weren't sure what it was going to do, and he offered me the opportunity to enroll in a study that was being done at several of the cancer research centers. And so I thought, should I help with the research? Should I help show? But Dr. McDougall pointed out, you know, we want, and this is a bit of reductionist thinking, we want this one variable, in your case, diet. We don't want it confounded with these other variables, you know, like chemo, radiation, and other drugs. As it turned out, it isn't reductionist in that the whole food plant diet has affected all these different aspects of human health, including fighting off the cancer cells.
Right. So, I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, you could have been a statistic in a study on tamoxifen. Instead, you've turned into, I'm not sure what, you know, to some people you're sort of an anecdotal case. Someone who sort of, you know, and to anecdotal cases are wonderful when they, especially when they contradict prevailing wisdom, where, you know, any researcher or medical practitioner with an ounce of integrity would look at your story and say, huh, there's something there.
Unfortunately, Howard, they don't. They said, well, that's an anomaly, or you're an outlier. This doesn't apply to mainstream. That's what I still get from most medical doctors.
Right. Well, and
of course, got a ways to go.
And you know, you and I think Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn both make the point that, you know, what you guys are doing is radical. No, what the medical cutting people open seems far more radical than eating well and exercising.
And dosing them with chemicals that kill mostly normal cells, and along the way, a side effect is they kill some cancer cells, but they kill far more normal cells than the cancer cells, and it still doesn't work because you can't kill them all without killing the patient, and you come very close to doing that.
Right.
And one of the other things that Dr. McDougall said that really resounded in my head was that this causes permanent damage to your immune system. And, of course, what we know now is the radiation to radiate the breast also causes damage to the heart. I don't think we knew that back in the 80s. So,
right. Well,
did I escape the bullet.
My dad developed prostate cancer, and he was irradiated and cured of the prostate cancer, and a year later dropped dead of a heart attack.
Wow.
So one can only wonder.
Yeah.
But so
he didn't change his diet, though, did he?
No, this was in the 80s, where even I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know. But you know, I'm curious. So in some cases you're an anecdote. You're sort of an interesting story, but you've also, through your outreach and your mission, you've also become a symbol for a lot of people. And I'm curious how you experience that. Because I know, you know, in the book you talk about not being able to do your work on an airplane because you keep overhearing conversations and have to set people straight. So it's not like, you know, it's a reluctance. You know, you have made this your mission. And because of your story, you know, arguably you're in a lot better position to convince people than McDougall or Esselstyn or me or almost anyone, because you're a living proof of it. And I'm wondering what that's like to be that symbol for something, a miraculous transformation, for lack of better words.
To be honest, it doesn't feel like that at all, because I live my life on a day-to-day basis. I've turned into a missionary of sorts, in that if I hear somebody saying something about diet, I'm immediately drawn in. Fortunately, there are more and more people now that have either, like you, we can connect with what we're saying, or they've heard they know somebody who's vegetarian, or they've read about Linda McCartney, but then they say, but she died of breast cancer. And I said, yeah, that's what dairy does to you. So it's not like feeling like an icon or anything. It's like I'm still drawn into these conversations and arguments, and sometimes I do turn people off. It's been pointed out to me that maybe you came down too hard on somebody, or they're not ready to hear the message. So it's still hard. I think we've got a long ways to go. I have hope. One of the fun things I like to say on my Facebook, when I get something from somebody, I'll say, are we winning yet? as a joke, because sometimes I think we are, and sometimes I think we're not, that I kind of view our civilization as Rome. You know, they had 500 years of civilization, 200 going up, 100 straight line, and 200 going down. I see Western civilization on that curve. I'm not sure exactly where. We're past the 200 going up. I'm afraid we're a little past the 100 straight line at the top. I think we're just the beginning of the fall, and it's not just civilization, it's the whole planet. That's what really scares me. And what we're up against is just such a formidable enemy that I don't know how we're going to win when you see all the rainforest being cut down to raise grain for cattle or to graze cattle. It just, I don't know, it gets pretty scary.
Yeah, I've been, after working on Whole, where the theme really is, you know, holism as opposed to this militant reductionist view.
Right.
So I'm preparing to do some talks on it and trying to distinguish my own views from those of Dr. Campbell, so I'm not just going out and aping what he would say.
Uh-huh.
And I came across a quote by the German thinker and poet Goethe, who basically said that nature turns mute under torture. And that kind of like put things in perspective for me, that what reductionist science and what human beings are trying to do to the planet is basically some form of torture or rape, in that it's for our own gain without any sense of relationship, without any sense of mutuality. And I see
exploitation.
Yes, and I see diet as kind of the center of that, because it's the way we interface with the world. It's how we take in the world, and that's why, you know, I see this shift to a plant-based diet as so crucial a step in coming to this revolution in perception, in this new form of consciousness.
Boy, I couldn't agree more. But in terms of mute, what happens next? I mean, I was thinking it was a science fiction novel that somebody ought to write about if we keep on this path and humans become extinct. What happens next? Kind of scary, huh?
Well, I guess not if you're a squirrel.
Well, yeah, maybe evolution starts all over again. And
I don't know. Have you seen the animated movie WALL-E?
No.
You should go watch it, because I think that might be the movie you're thinking of. It's a wonderful story where Earth is uninhabitable because it's so polluted. Humans are in a giant spaceship traveling for hundreds or thousands of years. They're so obese they can't get up from their lawn chairs. The robots are doing everything for them.
Wow.
When I saw that with my kids, it really struck me as a not science fiction, but kind of a linear progression if we don't change our consciousness.
Yeah, where we're headed. Yeah, you see the increase in obesity, and it's not just the U.S. I've been doing a lot of traveling in the last few years. I've been very fortunate twice around the world, stopping in different places, and I'm always looking to see what people are eating. And the rates of obesity, whether it's China and Japan or in Canada or Costa Rica, Europe, all over Europe, it's frightening. The rates of diabetes hitting younger and younger people, now young children even, and people don't want to exercise. You know, diet is extremely important. It's number one, but a close second is exercise. It doesn't do any good to get all these great nutrients in your body if you don't move them around. You sit too long, the blood doesn't move. It just pools in the legs and then causes clots, and you can have a healthy heart attack, you know, or a healthy stroke. And so anyway, I've just been a big proponent of exercise starting way back a little bit of history here. In 1968, way back in the dark ages, I read a book called Aerobics, written by Dr. Kenneth Cooper. And that book convinced me. I put it down after reading the whole thing in one sitting and went out for a run and was hooked. Thought, this is perfect, and thought it was the total answer. So for 14 years, I had been a runner, had even done a bunch of marathons, daily runners. I mean, get up in the morning and put on the running shoes after the usual morning ablutions, out the door, and I had an hour's run before going to work and was so energetic and healthy, I thought, very fit, no question. So exercise is extremely important, but it is definitely number two to diet. So to kind of sum up, there are two MDs, as it turns out, who turned my life around. First, Kenneth Cooper with his aerobics and exercise, which I'm still a total believer in, running now 45 years, and Dr. John McDougall with the diet. And what was really interesting is, you know, if you can draw, you know, the Venn diagram is a circle of your population.
Yeah.
You draw all the runners in the left-hand circle, and these are Dr. Cooper's runners, and here's Dr. McDougall's vegetarian, vegan, plant-based, and the right-hand circle, there is very little overlap, very little overlap, a little more now, and this is part of my mission, and I guess one reason why I feel I can do some good, because I can stand right in the middle of that overlap between these two circles and say, see, this works. You can't do just one. You gotta do them both.
Right, and you know, and there's probably a third circle that isn't touching either, that's sort of the paleo CrossFit weightlifters.
Oh, boy.
Right? The runners are all carbo-loading on pizza and bagels. The vegans are sitting still, and the weightlifters are eating everything that ever had a heartbeat or a mother.
Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah. I've tried arguing with some of the paleo types, and I don't know. It's so frustrating, especially people I have in mind, a doctor in physical therapy who is so gung-ho on paleo. And, you know, everything I say just goes right over his head, not in terms of, you know, not that he couldn't understand it if he tried. It's just that he discounts anything. He's been so convinced that animal protein equals human protein. I love the analogy that I came up with. I'm not sure how it holds up. You have a car, right, and it's made of metal, and it runs on gasoline. Mm-hmm. So the animal protein analog would be put liquid steel into the gas tank. And will it run? Well, no better than putting animal protein into our gas tank. Eating protein is not what makes our muscles contract. It's glycogen, which comes from, guess what, carbohydrates. And that's why I run best on an 80% high carbohydrate diet. And there's protein in every little bit of fruit, vegetable, leafy greens, and that's the old argument, you know, when people hear about my diet, but where do you get your protein? It's all over the plant kingdom. Same with calcium. Fortunately, my bone density is really high, and that's another area where exercise is so important. You can feed a person a very healthy, the healthiest possible diet, but put them on bed rest or out in space, they will lose bone. They will get osteopenia first and then osteoporosis. So that's one good argument for running. And people say, well, what about the impact? Isn't that bad for your joints? Well, I'm happy to let people know I've got another book, my fourth book coming out, which is Lifelong Running. My publisher, Martin Rowe Lantern Books, called me and said, you know, you've been running for 45 years now. You got me hooked on running. How about writing us a book on something like lifelong running? And it was funny. I thought, oh, gosh, running, writing is such hard work. It interferes with running and traveling and all that. And he said, well, think about it. So after we hung up, my next run, I started thinking, well, I could tell people this, I could tell them that, and that just launched it. I thought, wow. So in September, we've got this new book on eliminating the myths about running, about the joints, how runners have healthier joints than non-runners. There is a Stanford University study showing that runners' knees have no more arthritis than non-runners. They probably couldn't find enough subjects to run an experiment on vegan runners versus regular runners to show, but we know the outcome, right? They would have less arthritis because arthritis is a diet-related disease. It's from the animal proteins causing inflammation to get in the joint from the leaky gut syndrome. I mean, it all, but when you see the big picture, it all comes together so clearly.
Well,
but you've got to have all those elements, and that's what we're, you and I and a whole bunch of other people are trying to do.
Well, that's what I find so fascinating about people like you and Rich Roll and Brendan Brazier. Who are, you know, in our culture are kind of, are way out in the extreme, and yet looking at you provides better truths. You know, I'm looking at your book and then other things that I've read in the past week where there's just a study that came out that showed that jogging is basically bad for your joints.
And,
and you know, well, for, you know, certainly people who jog would notice their bad joints sooner than people who sit in front of the TV. But that is only true under the standard American diet.
Exactly. So
yes, there's truth to that study, but it's only a partial truth. You know,
yeah.
You talk about wine and, you know, any kind of alcohol being a toxin to the human body. Well, wine is good for you in limited amounts to prevent heart attacks under the standard American diet.
Yeah, where you have heart disease and it does tend to thin the blood, and it's a case of wine treating the symptom. And if you get rid of the cause, then you don't need to treat that symptom.
Right. So now I was reading also what you write about, you know, HDL and LDL cholesterol being focused on as opposed to the total cholesterol number, which, and those LDL and HDL are only important when total cholesterol rises above 150.
Yeah.
Yep. So, to me, that's like, let's outfit the Titanic with really good lifeboats. As opposed to maybe make the ship seaworthy to begin with.
Yeah, good
like the
analogy.
Lifeboats, you know, you're glad to have them at that point.
Yeah, accidents do occur. There are icebergs out there even today. I've been hit while cycling twice by trucks, and thank goodness for good ambulances and emergency rooms and X-rays, because accidents do occur. And with good medicine, and if you're fit when that accident occurs, you can survive and get back to where you were before. Another good reason to be fit and have a good diet. You can withstand all these little traumas that are inevitable. A lot of them caused by other people making dumb mistakes, like this truck driver who's getting ready to deliver a load of kitchen cabinets, and he's lost, and he is looking for this street, and he's driving along, and all of a sudden, oh, there's my street, and he makes a quick left turn, and I happen to be in the middle of the intersection on my bike.
Ouch.
And, you know, if maybe he had not been on the standard American diet, he might have been a little sharper, a little quicker in hitting the brakes, and or might have seen me. You know, his excuse was, I never even saw her.
Right.
So, anyway, that's a little
side story. How long ago was that?
It was 1998 that happened, and it took me quite a while to recover from that, and was told they had to put a titanium rod in my left leg because the bone was shattered so badly. And I was told, you'll never get back to running and racing again with all this damage. I said, get me in the water. Get me in the water. So I started water running and was able to keep from going downhill, you know, keep from that bed rest or being on crutches and obviously a wheelchair before the crutches. Because of getting in the water and started the water running, I was able to maintain that fitness while recovering from that almost fatal accident.
Wow. So you're proving doctors wrong left and right, yeah, aren't you?
Well, again, it comes back to the basic, the diet. It makes such a difference in realms that most people never even think of. I think every day we learn something. You know, I didn't know that's why my dandruff went away for a long time. You know, I just happened to notice, hey, gosh, same with the acne. These are minor things to most people, but to a teenager with cystic acne who is just devastated by all these pimples. And here dermatologists are telling them, oh, it's not your diet. No, it's not chocolate. It's not cheese. It's not, you know, it's just plain not true.
But well, again, they can't get enough people like you to be in that experimental group, right?
Yeah.
There's not enough data on vegan runners, on plant-free
vegan
kids.
Yeah,
but then every decade or so, a vegan baby dies, and that gets all the headlines.
Yeah, sure. And it's true that vegan can mean all kinds of things. It's got to be a healthy vegan diet, and that's why I wrote Chef, my cookbook. You know, Chef is an acronym: cheap, healthy, easy, and fat-free. Now, French fries and Coke are vegan, but they're certainly not healthy. And that's why I love eating lots of raw foods. My breakfast is raw completely. It's a big, big bowl of leafy greens, kale, and watercress, two of my favorite greens, and I eat a lot of it. And then one of the fortunate things about living in Hawaii, I ran down to the farmer's market. That was the 2 miles down, and before I got caught in the rain. Anyway, 2 miles down, picked up a bunch of papayas, mangoes, and bananas, and kale, watercress, and then ran back carrying these groceries and kept on running because it was raining. But that's my breakfast and every day. And it's not anything I get tired of because it's like probably an alcoholic looks forward to the first drink. You know, not a very good analogy, but you can understand how the attraction is very strong. I love eating this way. It is not about deprivation or sacrifice. It's, wow, I wish everybody else could eat this way and enjoy it as much as I do. And I don't know how we get them to, other than, you know, like Dr. McDougall has his 10-day programs, and I know the T. Colin Campbell Foundation is trying to train people. If we can just get them captive long enough to say, see, it works, people, it works, you know.
Right. Well, you know, and it's clear that it works. The worse your symptoms, the faster it'll work. So the trick is to find people who, before some symptom has become dangerous or debilitating.
Yeah.
And that's, that's why I like your outlook on fitness.
The cholesterol, I got to throw this story in. With my high cholesterol, Dr. McDougall said, don't worry about it. It'll come down when you change your diet. And it dropped 70 points in 17 days. And I thought, wow. So I started telling people about this. Now, again, that was 31 years ago. Last year, I heard on this medical radio, it's a call in to a doctor, an MD, call in to this doctor and was asked by the caller, I've heard that if you go to a strict vegetarian diet, you can lower your cholesterol and not have to take statins. And this doctor replied, well, yeah, it does work, but it takes months and months. And I'm yelling at the radio, you know, no, it doesn't. 17 days, you know.
Right.
And it keeps on going down after the 17 days. So, it, you know,
yeah,
people say it's too low, but it's not. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. I'm working with a company called Holvana, which is started by Nelson Campbell, one of T. Collins' sons. And we were talking, and he says, well, we do 10-day immersions with people, you know, providing all the food and, you know, education, support,
lectures, community.
Yeah. And, you know, they also get to meet you in Forks Over Knives.
Oh, good.
And I said, my first reaction was, well, 10 days isn't enough time to get any sort of meaningful measurement, right? He laughed. He said, take a look at the data from our immersions. You know, practically by day two, some of the more sensitive numbers start reversing themselves. Like the body is so damn hungry to be healthy.
And ready.
It's not going to waste any time.
Yeah. Dr. Terry Shintani here in Hawaii is doing 10-day programs. They're not the total immersion because they don't sleep over. Mm. So these people can cheat if they want to, but he does provide the daytime lectures and during the week, because a lot of these people are working during the day, so they meet in the evening, he provides all their dinners, does the blood work, has me come lecture them about exercise, and it makes a difference for diabetics. He gets them off their diabetic medication sometimes within 2 to 3 days. They're completely off. Most of them definitely have to lower their insulin or they get into hypoglycemic shock. Their aching joints, that goes away. They have more energy. They sleep better. So there are little pockets of hope springing all over.
Right. It's funny that all those doctors whom I know who do that, they're not the ones with the mansions and the 6 Beamers.
Oh boy, yeah. That's part of the disincentive. You know, how do you make any money? Like Dr. McDougall said, you know, I never see patients twice. If they do what I say, they don't need to ever come back. If they don't do what I say, they're embarrassed because they know that I would just bawl them out. So it's hard for medical doctors practicing this way to make any money.
Right. I was just rewatching Forks Over Knives a couple of days ago, and I was watching the doctors taking somebody around Whole Foods, or you know, showing him what to buy, and thinking, boy, how much would I pay if I were in serious shape, you know, if I had a real health problems, and I found a doctor who could give me that kind of treatment, who could, you know, with no side effects, no danger, just complete and utter reversal of all my disease symptoms, like, I would think you'd want to pay tens of thousands of dollars for that guy's personal attention. As opposed to waiting till you're under the knife and the surgeon comes in and the anesthesiologist come in and they rake up all the big bucks.
I don't think that's the way it goes.
Not yet.
Yeah. No, people would rather go to the doctor and just give me a pill. Make it a little blue pill, Viagra, so I can have some fun along the way and don't have to suffer. More pills. It's the fact that advertising misleads people so badly in terms of, you know, just look at television and listen, read magazines, the radio. There are all these supplements and drugs that will cure every ill. It's tempting, you know. People would much rather do that than have to give up their cheese or their steaks or their hot dogs, ice cream. What they don't know is there's wonderful substitutes that are healthy and just as enjoyable.
Right. That was one of the blessings for me of working for almost 14 months on the manuscript of Hole.
Oh, yeah.
That it just sort of reinforced every single day I would come to work on it. And it just reinforced that the principle, the product of the food and health marketing industries is confusion. It's not an accident that we're confused.
That's right.
Yep, as long as I'm confused, then I'm just going to, you know, one thing I learned as a marketer is the confused mind always says no.
Right.
So
right.
We'll just keep doing what we're doing. I'll trust, you know, even though I don't trust doctors, I have to trust them because there's nothing better. And there's enough people casting doubt on a plant-based lifestyle, on vigorous exercise, especially as we age, that it just seems safer to be as sick and tired as everybody else.
Yeah. The confused mind always says no. That is so, so true. It just, oh boy, and it's so easy to create confusion in people. They can hear a good lecture, like the Vegetarian Society of Hawaii, you know, the largest in the United States. And we've had Colin Campbell out to speak, and we have Dr. Terry Shintani, and we started with a bunch of people who were left when Dr. McDougall moved to California. You know, there were eight of us who were kind of at loose ends. What are we going to do now? So we got together and formed this group and had Dr. William Harris, who happened to have been a long-term ER vegan doctor, who wrote The Scientific Basis of Vegetarianism. He gave the first lecture, and I gave the second lecture, and this was 1990, and we've been growing ever since. Anyway, we bring these lectures in with good information, and we've had, like, Janet Stanger, and last week we had Mary Clifton. She's an MD in Michigan. All these great lecturers, and people walk out convinced, but the next morning, you know, because the support system is not set up. In fact, the support system encourages falling back to the old way of doing things. So every month we try to jack them up again, but, you know, and a lot of people never come back because they think, I could never do this. So I don't know where we go from here other than just to keep on trying.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that struck me about your story is that for you, that and you know, the beginning of the book, Senior Fitness, you start out by describing the operation where they removed the golf ball size lump from your breast,
mm-hmm.
and you were not under anesthesia, right? You kind of wanted to see what was going on. And I was like, I was reading that and thinking, this is like my worst nightmares. Like literally, I'm not using nightmare as like a metaphor.
But
like, this is like when things cut out of me, you know, I mean, this is like incredibly primal. And it seems like what you went through at that point was like a total transformation that then got rolled out in terms of the way you were going to, you know, you questioned everything. You had a moment where you decided you were going to fight for your life. And at that point, even if McDougall hadn't existed, you would have found him.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about what if. Yeah, I do remember them telling me it was cancer, and I'm thinking, there's no way. I run marathons, for Pete's sake. I'm as healthy, and I mean, just look at me. I'm fit. I look 20 years younger. I was always being carted, you know. And I thought, there's no way this could be cancer. There was none in my family. All my four grandparents lived to their 90s. Both mother and father were still at that point healthy. So I just flat rejected. And then they said, well, we're going to do the surgery. And because the biopsy didn't get it all, there were no clear margins, I said, I want to watch. I want to see what this thing is. And they said, no, you don't want to watch it. It's pretty gory. I said, I want to see it. And so when I'm getting ready for surgery, they're putting up the screen, the sheet from the neck up, and I said, no, I'm watching the surgery. The nurse says, does your doctor know this? And I said, you bet. So he comes in, and I'm numbed up, and I'm watching this whole thing, this golf ball. He kept cutting deeper and deeper and deeper, and I, you know, it was just, wow, you talk about teaching moments. I thought, boy, it is cancer. I'm doing something wrong. It's, of course, at that point, if somebody had said diet, these doctors would have said, no. You have a good diet. You don't eat any red meat. It's just chicken and fish and low-fat dairy. That's perfect.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it, boy, it had my attention. You know, I did not want to die.
Right. And it sounds like that everything you then started doing from that point was almost like a different person. Like it was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think that may be what's missing for people who come and listen to a lecture is that, the ego changes from the mind state. It's almost like a mutation as opposed to a transformation that they change. They'll go vegetarian for a few days, but they really haven't changed in their core being, in their perspective, the way you did. And what I love about your story is that, you know, just like any teaching story, it's much more powerful and profound than giving reasons and facts and figures. The people who hear your story and then see you, you know, vibrant and running and advocating this lifestyle 31 years later, that there's power in that can change people's, you know, at a very deep level.
Yeah. I remember the first year after the diagnosis, people would scoff and say, or mostly I imagine they would discount it. Well, you know, it's cure for a while, but we know 5 years is you can't count your being cured for 5 years. And if you make it to 5 years, well, then maybe. But then I knew that 5 years was just a theoretical, convenient time to pick. So once I made it 5 years, I didn't feel any sense of relief, of no recurrence of the cancer. And each year after that, I thought, here's one more year of validity, that it really does, it worked. And so when I hit 10 years and then 20, and I dare anyone now to argue, and then with 30 years, but then I start worrying, well, you know, 30, it seems so long ago to a lot of people. But not to me. You know how every once in a while you cough and I think, oh, I wonder if it's that tumor in the lung. And I think, no, it couldn't be. You know, so that fear is there. It never goes away, that possible recurrence.
Right. So I have to ask you, so you did the research, like a lot of us can do, even though you were sort of better equipped through your graduate training. You met Dr. McDougall, who's a very passionate, convincing guy, and yet you still had to implement it yourself. When did you know on a kind of a gut level, you know, a body wisdom level, that this was working?
The next morning. I had been constipated all my life. I mean, I had a fissure, an anal fissure at age 23. It was that hard. And yet that same proctologist said, well, 3 or 4 times a week is normal for some people. And I just had a feeling that couldn't be. It just wasn't, there was something wrong, that you don't have bloody stools and then have to have surgery. And so all these years of having horrible constipation, but refusing to take laxatives, thank goodness. And then the next morning, I thought, wow, this is what's been missing all this time. The fiber, the plant foods, and no animal foods. So right then and there, you know, I knew, if for no other reason, I was going to keep eating this way. And then 17 days later, with that tremendous drop in my cholesterol, I thought, wow, you know, it works for that too. And, you know, it was just one revelation after another. And then the hot spots and the bone scans started fading within 2 weeks. I thought, wow, you know, there's, how come the whole world doesn't know this? And then I started getting mad, you know. There's, people need to be told this. And then I found out, well, you can tell them, and it still doesn't work. You know, my ex-husband is still, I'm surprised he's still alive. But anyway, still not convinced. Isn't that incredible?
Mm. It's,
and
it
the argument of ED, we're getting really personal here. He had those problems, and I said, it's the diet, and it's the pills for your high blood pressure. Oh, that BS is his response to everything. I finally couldn't take it anymore, and I had to leave, so I did.
Wow, yeah, it's it seems like there's the chasm in understanding this is much deeper than facts. It's not it's not fact-based. You see so many intelligent, curious, open-minded people, but when it comes to what goes on their plates and on their forks, all of a sudden the rational discussion ceases.
Yeah, that's right. So
one other thing I wanted to touch on, and I know you've been very generous with your time, so I don't want to take too much more of it, but you write about the importance of, as we age, the cultural views on aging and views on seniors, on elders, whether they're you know, old people, senior citizens, or
warehouse.
Yeah, or elders. And I know that, you know, John Robbins has done a lot of work on finding the healthiest, you know, people in the world, the societies where most people live to 100 in vigor. And, you know, it occurs to me that, you're almost single-handedly, obviously, you know, there's lots of others, but you've taken on the task of kind of slapping our culture in the face a little bit and saying, this is what aging can be.
Yes. You know, where most people, as they age, in fact, I was kidding my baby brother, who just turned 73 on the 22nd, just a couple of days ago, and I said, what are you now, Don? 73. He said, 39. You know, everybody I know does not want to add another year. They want to either lie about their age or just not discuss it. Whereas I'm kind of the opposite. I'm 78. Wow. And, you know, I love the double takes, even with MDs that I see when I go for a checkup or just, you know, blood work, because I do like to monitor what's happening with everything. And it's so much fun getting older, in a perverse way. I can hardly wait till I hit 80, because I'm going to show people, this is what you can do at 80. I just hope it works, you know.
Yeah. And I find myself lying a little bit, too, where I was playing sports over the weekend, and I was getting a little winded. It was a very hot day, and we didn't have many subs, and I kind of made the excuse. I said, you know, I am 48, and I'm actually, you know,
as if that's old.
I'm actually 47 and 10 months, but I wanted to say 48. I could feel my like a little bit of vanity,
or almost 50.
Yeah.
So, pity.
At this point, I'm like, yeah, well, you know, the older my number, the better I look.
Yeah, there is that stereotype of, in this culture, not respecting our elders, and quite just the opposite. We disrespect, especially older women. There's a lot of sexism that still exists. Older women, that one quarter of society, you've got young and old, male and female, and that quarter of older females tends to be, you know, the myths about menopause and how hot flashes and how degrading that all is. Well, menopause, you know, we could open up a whole new chapter, which we haven't touched on. There's no reason for all of these symptoms It is diet and lack of exercise. But anyway, that's part of growing older that people need to know more about.
Mm. And, you know, and I think it's a two-way street there, that because of the ignorance around diet and exercise, we have, especially women, you know, aging in a way that makes what you do seem inaccessible, and that feeds into the stereotype of feebleness, and, you know, to the point of almost irrelevance.
Yeah.
You know, where I feel like a society that does not honor, you know, croning or crowning, you know, where you know, gosh, you know a lot more than I do about so many important things that I will never learn from a book, that I can only learn in my experience of you, whether it's this phone call or if I hope someday we meet in person. If you, by the way, if you ever want to invite me down to Hawaii to give a talk, I will be on the plane so fast I'll have to FedEx my bags.
Okay, we'll work on that.
But you know, the life interactions with people who have been through life, you know, stages of life that I don't have any experience with, and the tragedy that most of them are warehoused and their wisdom is inaccessible to me feels like a huge loss.
Yeah, and with dementia, it's slowly becoming inaccessible to them as well. That's why I got a lot out of Neil Barnard's book, The Power Foods for the Brain. That's an excellent book, too.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like there's could be dozens of books out there called Power Foods For, and you could put in just about every body part of disease, and it'd be the same damn book.
Yeah. Same damn foods.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, Dr. Ruth Heydrich, I am so thrilled to have had this time to talk with you. I want to thank you so much for taking the time, and I just know that people are going to be so inspired and moved and feel supported by your story. And if they want more of you, how do they get it?
Well, I have a website, which is ruthheydrich.com, RUTHHEIDRICH. And I have an Ask Dr. Ruth button you can push. And apparently when you Google, anybody Googles, and they come up with the Dr. Ruth, they're looking for the other Dr. Ruth.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so I get all these queries from people. I don't dare tell you some of the questions I get, but they are so sad in many ways and funny in others. So I do get to reach an audience that is not part of the choir here. I don't, unfortunately, like Dr. McDougall, I don't hear much back from them because they think, oh, my ED has nothing to do with diet, you know. But anyway, I have an Ask Dr. Ruth question button, which I do spend a lot of time answering questions. So I have a lot of fun with that, plus a lot of information in my books that I can't get through on email alone. So that's how you do it.
Well, I wonder if Ruth Westheimer gets questions about vitamin
B12. that would be good.
The other Dr. Ruth, the one who can cure your ED, it's wonderful to talk with you. You're the author of A Race for Life, The Chef, let me see if I can remember, Cheap, Healthy, Easy, and Fat-Free.
Yep.
Cookbook, yeah, Cook and Raw Book.
Yep.
Senior Fitness, and your new book coming out soon, Lifelong Running, Eliminating the 11 Myths of Running and Living a Healthier Life.
Yes.
Thank you so much. It's been a huge honor to talk with you today.
And thank you, Howard, for what you're doing. We all need to work on this together, so thank you for this opportunity.
Right on.
Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.